You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
At the center of Zoe Heller's third novel, The Believers, is a radical New York lawyer named Joel Litvinoff, whose catastrophic stroke throws his family into chaos. It's a portrait of a close-knit family and what happens when the linchpin of it is no longer there to hold it together. The book is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Zoe Heller back to the show today. Hi, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Hello, Leonard.
Many New Yorkers will immediately think of William Kunstler when they read your description of Joel Litvinoff. He's a flamboyant activist who represents radicals and revels in criticism from the right-wing press. Was Kunstler the model for your character?
No, not the model. I mean, he was certainly one of the people I was reading about when I started writing the book. But no, it's in no way based on his life.
And it is set after he died, 7 years after he died.
Right, 2002.
Even though this is not a post-9/11 book, did you want to set it after 9/11?
I think it is a post-9/11 book. I guess all books are post-9/11 books these days. It was for me significant that they were experiencing the particular traumas they experience in the year immediately following 9/11.
Your last novel, What Was She Thinking, which was made into the film Notes on a Scandal, was set in England, but this one's in New York because you pretty much live here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been living here for nearly 15 years or something.
You came here to write for Vanity Fair and then at The New Yorker?
Yeah. Exactly. I came here, in fact, thinking I was going to stay for a year and write a novel. And then actually it turned out to be more complicated settling into a new place, and I fell in love, and so here I am. Mm. And now I don't think I'm going back.
Oh, really?
No.
Housing is so expensive in London, not that it's cheap in Manhattan.
No.
Joel suffers a stroke in the first chapter and then goes into a coma. He basically disappears from the story except in how his family reacts to the tragedy. Why would you want to create such a colorful character and then immediately sideline him? Or should I assume that this novel is really about what it's like to be the wife of or a child of a famous man?
I think that's exactly right, yes. I know it does seem a little bit of an unkind trick. If you have developed any interest in this character in the first chapter, you're going to be sadly disappointed because he's about to go unconscious for the duration of the book. I think in some ways he is an absent presence throughout the book. He isn't there standing up and talking, but he's being remembered and talked about a great deal, and he influences all of the protagonists.
Now, everybody looks for autobiographical details in books. Well, his British-born wife, Audrey, is a short-tempered woman. At one point, you use the word harridan to describe her. I guess you're not being autobiographical here. Some reviewers have written that you specialize in creating unpleasant characters.
Yes, it's become the vexed question of my unpleasant characters. I was kind of horribly misquoted, I think, in the New York Times. They missed out some seminal clause, so it sounded as if I was saying the mission of literature is to write about horrible people. I don't think that, I have to own up to the fact at this point in my writing life that I do seem to specialize in quite, I wouldn't say unlikable, but difficult, tough characters.
But aren't they the more interesting ones?
Well, yes. First of all, I'd say, hey, you know, some of the finest characters in English literature are the difficult ones. But I think also I sort of slightly bridle at what I see as a trend in modern readership, as a demand for a bland kind of likability and inspiration and happy endings in books, in novels in particular. And I think if literature can be said to have any edifying purpose, it is precisely its ability to generate sympathy or fellow feeling for people who are different from you, people whose behavior you don't approve of or whose morals are ostensibly other than your own.
Sympathy or understanding? Mm. I mean, are you trying to understand what drives some people to act the way they do?
Well, yes. And I mean, I just think to understand is to sympathize.
Okay.
in many cases.
Shortly after Joel suffers his stroke, his wife finds out that he's fathered a child with another woman who demands that Audrey continue the support payments he's been making. I think most women would be angry in such a situation.
Yes, yes, she is. I mean, there are sort of two prongs to my response to the business about unlikable characters. One of them is, no, but my characters aren't. They're all rather lovable. They are, at least to me. The one sure way to frighten people is to say that Audrey, c'est moi, because I do actually find quite a lot of myself in Audrey, as alarming as that may seem. She's, she's a termagant, and she's very tough to be around. But I hope, if I have succeeded, I have shown how she came to be the monster that she is, and the sort of rather vulnerable person that lurks within that facade.
My guest is Zoe Heller, whose latest novel is called The Believers. And that title really is a clue to a major part of what this book is about. We haven't talked about it. It's how people commit to belief systems.
Right.
Joel's stroke affects their children. Their daughter, Rosa, I assume named after Rosa Luxemburg.
Indeed.
After spending 4 years in Cuba, has become disillusioned with socialism and is exploring Orthodox Judaism. So is she just replacing one belief system with another?
Yes, I think she is. I think for me, she is, someone with a real gift for conviction. And having become disillusioned with one theory of everything, it is, a short time before she begins to seek out another to replace it.
But it's often an unquestioning belief. They go from one unquestioning belief to another.
Well, I don't think you can say that about Rosa. She is definitely a questioner. And although this book is very much not against belief of any sort, if it's against anything, I guess it's against dogma and the tendency of those who believe passionately to close their ears to any new intelligence, any new information that threatens to contradict the things in which they believe most deeply.
Do you think it's the reason that we often see people rejecting their parents' beliefs? Children of conservatives become radicals. Children of atheists become very religious.
I think I'd be interested to know what the actual, see some research on that, because it seems to me that actually the opposite is probably the case, that teenagers tend to go through, their little phases of rebellion. But after a couple of years of dyeing their hair green, mm-hmm. as I did, I would imagine that most people, to a fairly amazing degree, end up replicating their parents' politics and values.
The other daughter here is Carla, spelt with a K. I'm assuming she was named after Karl Marx.
Yeah, you got it, Leonard.
Well, I've met people like this. and William Kunstler was a guest on the show.
He was a great man.
Carla is a hospital social worker whose union organizer husband seemingly married her to be close to her father. That is another problem when you're a member of a family where there is a great man at the head.
Right. I think the person who suffers most from their connection with the great man is Audrey. I mean, it's been something I've always been fascinated with, the idea of what it is to go home at the end of the night with the fabulous, charismatic, charming person who's had everyone in stitches all night. And I remember it striking me very as a very young girl watching somebody at one of my parents' dinner parties and thinking, that must be quite tough. And I think for Audrey to be the sort of invisible amanuensis to the great man is part of what has deformed her as a person.
Were you writing this novel when Bill Ayers became a part of the political campaign?
Oh, I was pretty much at the end of it, I think,
because,
by that point.
Because that story also seems to have inspired you. The Litvinovs have raised Lenny, the son of an imprisoned radical, who I'm assuming is based on Kathy Bodine to some degree anyway, mm-hmm. much as Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn raise Ms. Bodine's son.
Right. Well, I'd certainly read a lot about the Weather Underground and read about, I always think that's fascinating, the particular instance, and it happened not just in the case of Chesabudin, but in others, where people had to take over the care of the child of somebody who'd been incarcerated. And they were frequently activists themselves who had somehow managed to escape incarceration. And it always seemed to me that set of relationships had to be fraught with resentment and gratitude and all kinds of complicated things, you know, stuff of which novels are made.
Your two previous books had first-person narrators. This one is written in third person with shifting points of view, mainly between Audrey, Rosa, and Carla. Was that a challenge you set for yourself? Do you want each book to be to have to tackle more literary problems?
Yes, I think so. I think I feel as if I'm on a fairly steep learning curve still. This is my third book, and yes, I am trying to do different things and figure out how this stuff works. I never went to a...
So what's next, Finnegan's Wake?
Exactly. No, it's something in, you know, rhyming couplets. No, I never went to, a writer's workshop or studied fiction in any way, or fiction writing in any way. So I do feel as if I'm learning on the job, as it were. So yes, it's important to kind of try out new things. This was a tough one, I have to say. Moving into the third person was a great challenge for me.
Hmm. Some people find it easier, in fact, have a hard time with first person.
I know, I find that very comforting to hear that. I thought it was intellectually much more difficult, sort of 3D chess compared to first person.
Now, your second novel, I mentioned it earlier, What Was She Thinking? Notes on a Scandal, was made into a film starring Judi Dench and Cate Blanchett. I understand the rights to this book have also been sold, also to Scott Rudin, who produced the other film.
Right.
So you must have been happy with the way that film turned out.
I was very happy with it. I thought it was a really smart adaptation. I think part of the problem for writers when they hand over their book is the assumption that some sort of faithful translation is going to be made. I'm not even sure what that would be. Seems to me you have to, if you make this choice and hand over your work, you recognize it is going into a different medium and it will be something else. In the case of my book, which was, you know, an unreliable narrator, a first-person narrative, and so on and so on, it looked like a very unlikely choice for a movie adaptation. And it was clear that they were going to have to make some fairly radical changes to make it work on screen. And they did. But I think it works wonderfully within its own terms.
Well, it was also obvious to me that the two stars had read the novel and had understood what you were trying to do, what you were trying to say about their characters, and so their performances kind of overcame some of those problems.
Well, you see, I don't think they were problems.
The translation problems that you were talking about, going from an unreliable narrator, et cetera, et cetera.
I do think they were both amazing performances, and I only visited the set once. But I shall never forget walking onto the set of a kind of London pub and seeing Cate Blanchett dressed as my Sheba. And it was a very bizarre experience because I had sort of assumed nothing is going to be as it was in my head. And it wasn't quite, but she was as near as damn it.
Many writers have told me that they imagine a totally different kind of person than the actor who played the role. But after the movie came out, that was always the face that they attached to their own character.
I'm afraid that probably is the case. And that's why, I mean, that's the only bit that is very hard, I think, to deal with, is the fact that movies colonize the imagination. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I meet who say, haven't read the book, but I loved the movie. And there's a little part of me that you know, feels sad when they say that because, you know, even if they go to the book now, it will never be the same.
Would you want Vanessa Redgrave to play Audrey?
Well, sure. Why, is she offering? Will you bring her for me? No, that would be lovely, yes.
You're living in the Bahamas these days, even though you're a New Yorker?
Yes, but about 2 years ago, my husband and I realized, hey, we're both writers and we don't go to an office. We could write from wherever we wanted. And our kids are young enough to take out of school without too much trauma. And so first we wanted to go to, you know, we had this idea that we were going to go to all these exotic places. And we ended up fairly dully on a little island in the Bahamas. I mean, it's very lovely. It's just not the most exotic choice. And we've been very happy there. But we've got to come back and
And you're going to continue to write books set in New York?
Actually, the next book I write will probably be Bahamian. Actually, no, I'm not kidding.
I believe you. Zoe Heller's latest book is The Believers, and it is published by Harper. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with you again.
It's always a great pleasure. Thank you.